Punjabiya, Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari. Yashoda Nandana Rajachana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Rajachana Ranjana Yamuna Tiravanachari Yamuna Tiravanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari Gopi Jana Vallabha Girivardhari Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Vrajajana Ranjana Yamuna Tirava Askipari Yamuna Tirava Nachari Yamuna Tirava Nachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Radha Madhava Jaya Om Vishnupad Paramahansa Puri Vraja Kacharja Ashtotra Chacha Shri Shimad His Divine Grace Iskan Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki Go to Premanandi. Actually, I cannot. But thank you so much. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Reading Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, chapter 8, text 13. Patishu chamugda bhavena tatra tatra vishakta mati pranay bara hridaya karpanayat skandhaned vadhati evam utsanga orasi chadhaya o palayanam mudam paramam avapa. Patishu, on the forest paths, cha, also mugda bhavena, by the childish behavior of the deer, tatra tatra, here and there, vishaktamati, whose mind was too much attracted, pranaya, with love, bhara, loaded, hridayaha, whose heart, karpanyat, because of affection and love, skandhena, by the shoulder, udvahati, carries, evam, in this way, utsange, sometimes on the lap, urasi, on the chest while sleeping, cha, also, adhaya, keeping, upalalana, fondling, mudam, pleasure, paramam, very great, avapa, he felt. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada ki. When entering the forest, the animal would appear very attractive to Maharaj Bharat due to its childish behavior. Maharaj Bharat would even take the deer on his shoulders and carry it due to affection. His heart was so filled with great love for the deer that he would sometimes keep it on his lap, or when sleeping, on his chest. In this way he felt great pleasure in fondling the animal. Purport, Maharaj Bharat left his home, wife, children, kingdom, and everything else to advance his spiritual life in the forest, but again he fell victim to material affection due to his attachment to an insignificant pet deer. What then was the use of his renouncing his family? One who is serious in advancing his spiritual life should be very cautious not to become attached to anything but Krishna. Sometimes, in order to preach, we have to accept many material activities, but we should remember that everything is for Krishna. If we remember this, there is no chance of our being victimized by material activities. Om Aganati Mirandasya Jnananjala Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. It may seem incredible that a person could renounce the entire rulership of the earth. He was the emperor of the entire earth. And then again become attracted by a deer. It would seem impossible, actually. Something we could never imagine. The point is to show us how powerful Maya is. We should realize how powerful Maya is. Prabhupada had many very stalwart disciples who were actually very advanced in spiritual life, and they fell victim to Maya. And they were superior, certainly superior to me, so how much anxiety I should have, or us in general, about how easily we can be swept away by the power of Maya. As soon as we become a little bit proud, then we lose the protection of Krishna. As long as we're humble and we're strictly following sadhana bhakti and trying to serve the Vaishnavas and trying to control our senses and reading Srimad Bhagavatam every day diligently, then we're actually protected by the daivi shakti, the internal potency of the Lord. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, the great souls, the Mahatmas, are under the protection of the Daivi Shakti. So even a new devotee has such protection as long as he remains humble and dedicated and strictly adheres to the order of the spiritual master. There's no question of being genuinely humble or dedicated if we are not strictly following the order of the spiritual master. So that protection is the strict following of the orders of the spiritual master. But then in the course of carrying out sadhana bhakti for a few years, we may actually become advanced. It can happen very quickly. I've seen it, especially during Prabhupada's time. I mentioned the case of Bali Mardan Prabhu. He joined in 68 in New York. And in 1969, he was only 1 year in the movement, Prabhupada said, I want someone to go to Australia. With no money, they had no money in those days. And he went alone, entirely. First he went to Japan with one other devotee. They set up a whole center in Tokyo. And then, at least he had some association for that spiritual enterprise. But on the trip to Australia, he had absolutely no one. He was entirely alone to a brand new continent, a devotee who had been in the movement only 1 year. And he succeeded. He came there with no money. He had to live in hippie, just, they were ruined houses with all the windows were broken. They were giant cockroaches. The cockroaches were several inches long. Everything was completely run down. And people, the hippies there were smoking day and night marijuana. And actually, that was the most innocent of all the substances that were being ingested. But he succeeded. He got people to join. Then Prabhupada sent Upendra, his personal servant. And then books came from America and they began distributing. Within a couple of years, Sydney Temple was the number one distributor in the world. Prabhupada was so pleased he gave him sannyas, Bali Mardan, and he was only like 20 years old. And only in the movement for 3 years, and now he's a sannyasi. Now how difficult is it? How rapidly from a past background of totally, you know, absorbed in material nature up to that status. He was GBC for the whole South Asian area. A sannyasi, highly respected, and then just after 1 year after sannyas, then he got into difficulty. He's far superior to me. The point of the story is not to find fault with him, but just to show how powerful Maya is. And there are other examples in our movement of devotees who are actually much more advanced than I am, and they got into tremendous difficulty. So that fear should catch hold of our heart. Prabhupada told his Western disciples, the problem with you is you're not sufficiently afraid of Maya. We don't realize how easily we can be swept away by the illusory energy. One good meditation is to always remember how much we suffered before we became a devotee and how nice our peak experiences in Krishna consciousness are. These things will actually protect us from the onslaught of ignorance and illusion. Now, since the last few classes I made went over time, I think I will just ask for questions at this point.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu.
I was just thinking about simplicity. You were mentioning how strong Maya is, and it seems that it's inconceivable how could, you know, a devotee who is so fixed up get pulled away. And I was just thinking, I guess things get very complicated and you feel kind of trapped. So could you discuss a little bit about this principle of simplicity and like Maya and Maya being like the complexities of Maya that are there and cultivating simplicity?
The real problem is our backlog of previous non-devotional psychological tendencies, not even karma, because karma is very rapidly destroyed by circumambulating Tulsi, by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, taking Mahaprasad, seeing the deities. Every aspect of our lifestyle annihilates past karma very easily. So it's really not a karma problem. The problem is our desires. We have a reservoir of desires. Even though we may entirely want to be Vaishnavas, our mind has not agreed to the proposal. And that's what takes generally decades, or even longer. Actually, Prabhupada made it possible within decades. Generally, it takes many lifetimes. So one after 2 or 3 years may actually be advancing very nicely and can do wonderful service for Prabhupada's mission, but as soon as you're a little inattentive, the massive backlog of desires for honor and reputation, what to speak of gross sensual attraction, if you're just you step out of line a little bit, those things overwhelm you very rapidly. So simplicity is one of the qualities, brahminical qualities, that naturally develops. I wouldn't necessarily focus on that one. There are many enemies within that we have to deal with. But rather than focusing on that, just stay on the strict path. Basically, just stay on the strict path. Keep an association of devotees. Always hear and chant. For example, if in the evening you don't read some Krishna book before you take rest or some pastimes of the Lord, then we'll have lusty dreams, it'll be hard to get up in the morning, the next morning it's tough to concentrate on rounds, then we'll overeat for breakfast because we didn't get any taste from our chanting, then we don't feel like going on book discussion, then it's actually you're cycling down. Maya has each time you lose something, you get pulled down one notch. And then as you're pulled down, your enthusiasm goes lower and you begin to doubt that the process is efficacious. Even though a couple days ago you were dancing in ecstasy like a jubilant peacock in a massive kirtan, Maya is so potent that within a few hours you can forget. You can be pulled down systematically. So the basic thing is really to focus on the things that Prabhupada considered to be important, like Mangalartik. Just hearing the prayers of Mangalartik and meditating on their meaning is extremely potent. And prayers of Tulsi Puja are extremely potent. All of these, everything, whatever Prabhupada gave us to chant every day is packed. It's like saturated with spiritual advancement, the potency to give us spiritual advancement. This, you might say, is a kind of austerity, because at first it seems very mechanical to the mind to focus on these prayers. But the magical aspect of devotional service is when you try to do something right to please Prabhupada, it becomes attractive. At first it's difficult and mechanical and artificial. And then it grows within your heart. It begins to transform within your heart into something extremely attractive. So the main focus is the positive thing. We know we have a mountain of anartas lurking beneath a thin veneer of Vaishnavism. So we already know that. That's a given. And there's not much value in just thinking about that or repeating that. So mainly fill up with the positive. In the 70s, when Prabhupada was on the planet, the whole mood was, let's do something for Prabhupada. Let's go to a new continent and start Krishna consciousness with no money. I don't think any of us, even devotees who have been much longer, because they had such a group mood, everyone was inspired to do it nowadays, I don't think any of us would be really willing to do that. Maybe we would. But there was no hesitation in those days. Everyone was thinking how to please Prabhupada. In Lilamrita, it's described that Prabhupada would sit in front of a globe of the entire earth, and he would spin it around, and he would say, Brahmananda, do you want to go to Russia? Gargamuni, will you go to China? Prabhupada had huge visions, see, right in the beginning, in 1966. And the boys were just thinking, well, this is kind of like... It's impractical. We're barely, you know, we have one center, 26 Second Avenue. We're struggling to pay the rent. And Prabhupada is talking about taking over the world. Actually, Prabhupada knew he would succeed. In Lilamrita, there's one description how he was sitting on a bench, a park bench, and this one Turkish Jew named Mr. Rubin came up to speak with him. And this Mr. Rubin could sense that Prabhupada had a deep vision for how things would happen in his life. He had a reservoir of tremendous spiritual potency, even though he was entirely alone. So Prabhupada said, I actually have many temples packed up with devotees, more than 100 temples all over the world, full of devotees and many books. That was before anything was visibly manifest. Prabhupada was exhibiting his tri-kala-gya potency of actually seeing the future. This is one of the features of a pure devotee. He actually sees the future. So from Prabhupada's vantage point, everything was unfolding according to Krishna's inconceivable plan. That's how a pure devotee operates. He sees Krishna's inconceivable potencies, and he just wants to play whatever role Krishna wants him to play. Even if that role involves his personal defamation, that's the test of his purity. He plays any role, even though it may not be a very attractive role. For example, Maharaj Parikit. Just a week ago, Rohan Pad Maharaj told the story. Maharaj Parikit had to do what would destroy his reputation forever, namely insulting a Brahmin. In those days, the Kshatriyas were so diligent. Even Jarasandha, who was an atheist and was against Krishna, he was willing to give up his life to please Brahmins. When Krishna came in disguise with Bhimasena and Arjuna, it was an amazing trick how to conquer Jarasandha most effectively. They decided to dress up like Brahmins. So they went to the capital city of Jarasandha. And he thought, well, they look a little familiar, and they don't look like Brahmins because they have heroic builds. A Kshatriya has a heroic build. Brahmins are skinny and austere, and intellectuals. But these were big, like Bhima. I mean, how is Bhima going to get away with looking like a Brahmin? He was huge. He could throw elephants. He did. In the Battle of Kurukshetra, he would throw elephants and kill dozens of warriors at once. So anyway, they came there. And Jarasandha said, whatever you want, I will give you, because you're Brahmins. Even if you ask for my life, I'll give you my life. And he was a rascal. That's like the lowest standard of a Kshatriya. The Kshatriyas were so obedient. Or Maharaj Dasarath, the father of Lord Ramchandra, when Vishvamitra came to see him, he was ready to do anything. He fainted due to anxiety to give away his son to Vishvamitra, but he's ready to do anything to please the Brahmins. So for a Kshatriya to insult a Brahmin, that was like worse than death. But that was what Krishna wanted him to do. That was how the setup for the speaking of Srimad Bhagavatam was actually arranged. So he had to drape a dead snake around a fully qualified Brahmin. Or the gopis, to serve Krishna, they had to commit social suicide, because for a young girl to leave home at night to dance with another man that they're not married to, this is social suicide, actually. No, she could never get married again. That's part of, in the Mahabharata, when Bhishma, he kidnapped Amba to bring home. Bhishma had taken a vow, he was so powerful, he had taken a lifelong vow of celibacy. But he wanted to bring her home, Amba, for his brother, Vichitravirya. So Amba could not marry anyone else. And then Bhishma decided not to marry her, so she was totally fried. She went to Parashuram, who is the supreme personality of Godhead, a great Brahmin, and the best fighter on the whole planet. Of course, when the Supreme Lord wants to fight, he's the best of all fighters. And he was actually the military instructor of Bhishma. He was the spiritual master. So he came to Bhishma and said, what did you do? You kidnapped this girl and now you're not going to marry her? I order you to marry her. And Bhishma was very humble. He's a Mahajan. He's not just a Vaishnav. He's one of the great authorities, the 12 Mahajans listed in the sixth canto. So he, with very great respect to his guru, with ultimate respect, he said, oh my dear spiritual master, I've taken a vow to please his father. He took a vow, a lifelong vow of celibacy to please his father. And he said, I've taken this vow. I will do anything to satisfy you. I am your servant, but I cannot. How can I go break my vow? And then again and again, Parashuram said, you must. I order you or else I will kill you. I will punish you. You're so puffed up. But Bhishma was not actually puffed up. He was very humble. He kept on with great humility, begging his Guru Maharaj, please consider the circumstances. I'll do anything, whatever I can do, but I cannot break the vow. Can I do something else? And Parashuram said, no, I will punish you severely. I order you, we will fight. So they went to Kurukshetra long before the battle. This was long before the Battle of Kurukshetra. And it was very dramatic. Many great devas came to watch. All kinds of great rishis and personalities came, because these are two of the greatest fighters in the whole universe. Parashuram was the greatest fighter at the time, and his best disciple was Bhishma. And Bhishma is actually one of the eight Vasus, a demigod from the higher planets, came to Earth for certain pastimes. So these are superhuman personalities. They began hurling weapons at each other that would destroy mountain ranges. They fought with the most incredible Kshatriya skills and celestial weapons. Each of them could fight against the demigods. And they fought for day after day after day, and they fought to a standstill. And after 30 days, the Parashuram said, "I bless you to be the greatest fighter. I cannot defeat you." So Parashuram blessed him to be the greatest fighter of his time, and he actually was. He was the greatest fighter. He was even better than Arjuna and Karna. Bhishadeva allowed himself to be killed by Arjuna and Shikhandi, otherwise he could not be killed. He was too powerful. He had gotten a benediction from his father that he could stay in his body as long as he desired. No one could make him leave his body. Only when he himself, of his own accord, desired to leave his body, would he actually leave his body. That's how powerful Bhishadeva was. And during the course of the 18 days of the Battle of Kurukshetra, as day after day was going by, Arjuna was, of course, fighting heroically. But the Pandavas were in difficulty because Bhishma was so powerful. He was mowing down the Pandavas' army. So Yudhisthira, every night they would have a meeting all to discuss strategies. So Yudhisthira came, they were all sitting together, the Pandavas, and Krishna, of course, was there as their advisor. So Yudhisthira said to his brothers, "The grandfather is mowing down our army." Bhishadeva was their grandfather. The grandfather is like a lion going through a pack of sheep. He's annihilating our whole forces. I don't see what we can do, but he's our beloved grandfather. We cannot kill him. But Krishna was very stern. Krishna was always very stern about duty. So Krishna said he must be killed. But how can we do it? The Pandavas said, we're fighting to our best capacity. Bhishmadeva is simply too powerful. He could hold off all the Pandavas together. He was literally invincible. He could not be defeated, only if he himself chose to be defeated. So Krishna said, you go to him at night and he will tell you how he can be defeated. So they went. It's an interesting feature of the Kshatriya Dharma that at the end of each day of the Battle of Kurukshetra, the Kshatriyas would actually meet, even though they would fight to the death during the day, tooth and nail. It was like a bloodthirsty, you know, the most intense desire to defeat your enemy with full prowess. But at night they would join as friends together and joke and laugh together. Because it's based, they have respect for each other. So the Krishna said to the Pandavas, "You should all go to the camp of the Kurus on the other side of the battlefield." It was a big battlefield. They had to go at least 10 miles. It's a huge battlefield. So they went to the other camp to ask Bhishmadeva how he could be killed. And they came into his tent. Each of the great generals had a tent. So the Pandavas came in and they bowed down with great respect before Bhishma. And they had tears in their eyes because Bhishma actually raised them when their own father, Pandu, died at an early age. So Bhishmadeva was their beloved grandfather, and he raised them, not out of duty, with great love and affection, and trained them in many ways, arranged for their military training, and just basically loved them and protected them. So they had a deep, loving relationship, and they're all pure devotees on top of it. Bhishmadeva is a great Mahajan, and all of the Pandavas are pure devotees. And Bhishma is a pure, how can you, you have to kill a pure devotee in battle. So with tears and their voices were faltering and cracking, they couldn't even speak properly. The Pandavas, and Yudhisthira was the leader, the eldest brother. So with great deep love and respect, they said, "It is our duty. You understand everything." Bhishma was on the opposite side by Krishna's arrangement. The arrangement was that Krishna wanted to show that even the greatest warrior, if he goes against the program of God, he cannot succeed. So Bhishma knew he would lose. He simply fought out of duty. He didn't even like Duryodhana. He was very displeased with Duryodhana's qualities or lack of qualities. And he was displeased with Karna. Bhishma was always very heavy with Karna, and Duryodhana called Duryodhana a fool. Said, you should surrender. Every day he would tell Duryodhana, you should surrender to Yudhisthira. Give up this nonsense. Give him half a kingdom. That's all he wanted. It's not that Yudhisthira demanded to have the entire earth planet. Yudhisthira was so humble, he was ready to accept 5 villages. But as a kshatriya, he had to rule something. That was his dharma. That was his duty. Actually, he was like a Brahmin when he was exiled to the forest. Yudhisthira had such exalted qualities, even though a kshatriya, he would just associate with rishis all day and discuss the shastra, and he was totally happy. He was thinking, this is revealed in Mahabharata, Yudhisthira was thinking, I'd rather just stay in the forest. I can chant the holy name of the Lord and discuss the shastra with the rishis. I don't want to go back to the city. He was a rishi. He was a king. I mean, he was a great sage. Arjuna and Bhima, they were just waiting for the chance to kill Duryodhana and annihilate the Kauravas. They were very dissatisfied with being in the forest, Arjuna and Bhima. They're also pure devotees, but they had this kshatriya spirit. So Yudhisthira, he begged Bhishmadeva, he said, it is our duty. And Bhishmadeva was in ecstasy. As a pure devotee, is always, even though in a very difficult situation, it's an interesting feature of Mahabhagavats or Uttama Adhikaris. Anything they do, they're constantly absorbed in ecstasy. That's the nature of an advanced pure devotee. They have to play a certain role for Krishna's pastimes. This is the point. They may have to play a very intricate role. There may be lots of intrigue, palace intrigues. The Mahabharata is full of intrigue and secrecy and duplicity and diplomacy and all the things that pure devotees don't usually like to do, except if it's for Krishna. That's what it means to be a pure devotee. Anything that Krishna desires. So Bhishma was really happy. He said, yes, I'll tell you how you can kill me. I have taken a vow. I will not shoot my invincible arrows at women or persons who are initially women. And then Shikhandi, this is a long, I won't go into the whole story, but Amba was the Mataji I mentioned that Bhishmadev kidnapped to bring to his brother Vichitravirya, but decided not to marry. That Vichitravirya didn't marry her, and so she had no one to be married, and she couldn't go back. She was really fried, so she took a vow and she did heavy penances, and then she took birth as Shikhandi in her next life, initially as a woman, but then was trained into a man. So Bhishmadev, I will not fire at Shikhandi. So you put Shikhandi in front of Arjuna, and Arjuna can fire at me from behind. I will only be killed by Arjuna. I will not allow myself to be killed by anyone else. And he happily explained, this is really far out, Bhishmadev very jubilantly, the Pandavas were heartbroken. But Bhishma is so pure, he's transcendentally situated, that he, this is my role, this is what Krishna wants me to do, so this is what's going to happen. And that's what actually did transpire. And Arjuna was, tears were pouring down at his cheeks. He couldn't even practically fire, but he had to. Krishna ordered him to fire. You must kill Bhishma. So Arjuna, again, he had to surrender. He's also a pure devotee. So he surrendered, and he was firing arrows into the body of Bhishmadev and crying, and Shikhandi was there, and so Bhishma didn't fire back because Shikhandi was right there and Arjuna was behind. And then Bhishma fell on the battlefield, and it was like the most intense moment. Everyone was shocked. How could Bhishma? He was invincible. And he fell on the battlefield, but he didn't give up his body again because he was so powerful. He remained in his body, even though his body had hundreds of arrows. There was hardly enough room to stick your finger in between each of the arrows. That's how many arrows were transfixing his whole body. And he was just laying there with arrows through his body for many days. He was brought down, I forget which day, like around the 9th or 10th day, and there were 18 days in the battle. So for another week or more, he was just laying there. They respectfully cordoned off an area, so the battle moved to, the next day's battle didn't interfere with him, so he was just laying there. on a bed of arrows. And the Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 9, describes this and describes his instructions. Even though he was full of arrows, he gave the most brilliant and lucid instructions. Because Krishna wanted to show that his pure devotees are the best of all personalities, the most learned of all personalities. Yudhisthira was, after the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Yudhisthira was very much lamenting. He was thinking, this body which is meant to help other living entities, a good man thinks this body is the destiny or the purpose of this body is to help others. And this body has been the vehicle to kill millions of men. And now millions of women are without husbands and their lives are ruined and I've committed the most sinful and abominable activities. This is how pure Yudhisthira was. He knew that it was Krishna's desire. He only fought because Krishna wanted it, but he was so pure-hearted. He always attributed his own faults. A low-class person attributes faults to everyone else. Always blames everyone else. Whenever there's a problem, a low-class person is very eager to blame others. And an exalted person is always eager to see how it's his own fault. He takes the blame on himself. So Yudhisthira was like that. And then Krishna began speaking wisdom. And who is more wise than Krishna? This is all in the first canto, chapter 9, explained in great detail in purports by Srila Prabhupada. So even Krishna, who is the most brilliant speaker of all and the wisest person of all, he couldn't pacify Yudhisthira because Krishna was in Yudhisthira's heart as Paramatman, and the Paramatman in Yudhisthira's heart did not allow Yudhisthira to be pleased, even though Krishna himself was speaking. And it wasn't until Yudhisthira went to inquire from Bhishma Dev, again, Krishna wanted to put his devotee in a superior position. He wanted Bhishma Dev's instructions to be more powerful than his own instructions for Maharaj Yudhisthira. And Bhishma Dev was physically incapacitated. How can you give a lecture, a Bhagavatam class, if you're transfixed with hundreds of arrows? But he actually did. He gave such a learned discourse. It's described in the ninth chapter of the first canto. His discourse was so erudite and learned, all the great sages from all over the universe came. Like Bharadraj and Vishvamitra and Vasishtha Muni, all the great high-class Brahmins, the Raja Rishis, the Rajarshis of the whole universe came with all mystic powers. They came from higher planets just to hear Bhishma Dev speak. Again, Krishna wanted to put his devotee in a higher position. He allowed Bhishma Dev to speak more convincingly than he himself. So Bhishma was just waiting for a certain point as the sun reached a certain point heading towards the northern course. Then he fixed his mind after giving a brilliant discourse to Yudhisthira, and Yudhisthira was pacified that he had done his duties properly. That's what Bhishma explained. You did your duties properly as a kshatriya. You had to fight. Your fighting was not wrong. you incur no sinful reactions, even though you slaughtered millions of men. So after giving a brilliant discourse, then Bhishma, he just fixed his mind on Krishna. Krishna was sitting there the whole time, listening, as though the disciples. Imagine how Krishna is. He's sitting there listening, and Bhishma Dev is giving the discourse because he wants to show that his devotee is even better than himself. This is the amazing feature of Vaishnava theology. In Christianity or the Muslim religion, there's no understanding that God wants to put his devotee in a superior position. That Krishna actually desires to put his devotee in a superior position, to glorify his devotee. Krishna will just sit there humbly. All the Pandavas were sitting there listening. Bhishma was laying on a bed of arrows. There's a beautiful painting in the first canto, chapter 9. He's laying there in a bed of arrows speaking perfectly lucid discourse on the dharmas and the duties of Brahmins and Kshatriyas. He went on and on for a long time, many days, speaking. And Krishna's just sitting there listening humbly, and all the Pandavas are sitting there with folded hands, listening. This is a very standard feature. It happens again and again that actually Krishna wants his pure devotees to be more glorified, to be put in a superior position. Krishna doesn't have a big false ego. Krishna doesn't want to always be recognized as God. Of course, how can God have a false ego? He has a true ego, and he truly is the greatest. But his true ego, in recognition of his greatness, is also includes the desire to put his devotees in a superior position. He's not really attached to being worshipped. This is a very amazing quality of God. We're thinking, if I could be God, how nice it would be. Everyone would respect me. I really want to be respected and worshipped by everybody. If I had the power and the potency, this would be really great. I could speak and everyone would do what I say. I could do anything. I could lift planets and create universes and do anything I want. But Krishna, he's not thinking like that. He does that also. He has those leelas because as Narayan or as Allah or as Jehovah, he functions in that capacity. But he doesn't, it's described in the Shastras amazingly enough that what he really prefers is when his lovers chastise him, when he has to take a humble role, when Lalita or Srimati Radharani chastises him severely, or when Mother Yashoda ties him up, or when Sridharma climbs on his shoulders and says, "You're not such a big man, I can defeat you easily in a wrestling match. How did you get such a big reputation anyway? This is all nonsense." The coward boys, they're very rowdy, actually. They like to joke with Krishna and they like to make fun of Krishna. And Krishna prefers that to the reverential prayers of the Vedas. When the sages are offering prayers, or in Vaikuntha, everyone is glorifying the Lord. He accepts that. If you want to worship him like that, he's so liberal-minded, he accepts any bona fide form of worship. But what he really likes is when Sridharma climbs on his shoulders, or Stoka Krishna, and they minimize his value and say, how did you get such a big reputation as being so powerful? I mean, obviously you're not very strong. We can beat you up easily. We do it every day. So he really likes that, and these devotees are so pure that to serve Krishna, they're covered by yoga maya, so they don't even recognize that Krishna's God. And Krishna also forgets that he's God. The great acharyas inform us that he is simultaneously sarvajna, that means omniscient, and mugda, that means enchanted or bewildered in such a way as to forget that he's God. How he can simultaneously know he's God and not know he's God is inconceivable to us. But it shouldn't be a big surprise that Krishna's psychology is inconceivable, because everything about God is inconceivable. He's in every atom. He's making the blood pump in your body right now, effortlessly, in all of trillions of bodies, just on this one planet alone. And there are many planets in this universe, and there are far more than trillions of universes. The number is said to be asankhya. Uncountable. And he does all this, he says, with one spark of his splendor. In the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, he informs Arjuna. All of this control of the material energy, he does with one insignificant spark. Krishna's power is literally inconceivable. Or that we are able to see ordinary household objects means he has to, for all of us, he has to translate all these complicated electrochemical events, which are encoded by the retina. He has to translate that into our conscious perception of objects, otherwise we couldn't see anything. We described this earlier in a whole class, that the output fiber of each eye, called the optic nerve, actually it's not a single conduit, it consists of a million axons of these ganglion cells hooked together. So it's a million fibers of information, a million trains of electrochemical impulses per second are traveling along the optic nerve. Krishna can deal with all this stuff effortlessly, but he doesn't, even though he's worthy of glorification, and any sane person would glorify God, but God himself doesn't really feel so enlivened, he enjoys it. He enjoys everything, being the supreme enjoyer, but he's not really so attached. He's not attached to being glorified. And Krishna is perfectly happy in Sri Vrindavan Dham, where no one glorifies him. where he's insulted and minimized. Jatila and Kutila are always saying he's a debauchee, he's unreliable, we know he's doing bad things all the time. He's totally unreliable and very, very, very low character, this Krishna. He's very, everyone better watch out for Krishna. He likes that better. Just see how, and worse, the materialist is so eager to be glorified and so angry when someone insults him. But yet he has no position. He has no real position worthy of being glorified. But he's mad after being glorified. And if he does get some power, he exploits it to the max. But Krishna has no interest in that at all. So naturally, pure devotees also are not attracted to being worshipped and honored. As we get purified, this is a test. You can look in your own psychology and see how much you enjoy being honored and praised by others. And if you enjoy being praised by others, that means we have a lot of work to do. We're not very advanced. So Maharaj Prickett, he happily played the role that would gain him everlasting defamation among the materialists, and that those who are not in knowledge of the higher understandings of bhakti, or the gopis, they really had to undergo a lot of defamation, social defamation, for doing what they did. But they do anything to please Krishna. Or Maharaj Yudhisthira, or Bijadeva, look at all the difficulties. Or Arjuna, they had to undergo so many difficulties just to satisfy Krishna. So these are the wonderful qualities of pure devotees, and we should try to emulate as much as we can. Book distribution is very good because one has to undergo tremendous difficulties to distribute. But to sneak into a festival, one may have to hide underneath the deck of the van. If the van is set up, it has like a false floor, a deck underneath, so you hide under the deck or hide on the roof or whatever it takes to get in to the festival. And it may be very hot in the middle of the summer. It's roasting hot. One has to undergo great difficulties to please Krishna. So this, we have to train. We're in the training process. If we actually want to become a pure devotee, we read in the Shastra about pure devotees. And then Krishna says, all right, if you really want to become a pure devotee, then here is the facilities for doing that. There are ways to do it. There are facilities at all times and places. The spiritual master gives a range of instructions. And some of the instructions involve severe austerities. And if we take on the severe austerities, then we make rapid advancement. We make tremendous advancement. And we receive Lord Chaitanya's mercy if we're eager to satisfy the desires of the spiritual master. So are there any other questions or...
It happens that we try to emulate that characteristic to the other devotees, but the other devotee is not ready to accept that thing. It may be too overwhelming to the devotee. Suppose we take care of the devotee, it might be too much overwhelming to the devotee. So in that situation, how to balance that thing?
As I mentioned, there's a spectrum of instructions from mild to wild. If one does not feel ready for accepting the highest austerities, one can do many services to please Krishna. One can please the Lord by being an expert pujari or by college preaching. One doesn't have to do necessarily the most severe austerities. You shouldn't force another devotee to do austerities. You yourself should take on the austerities.
Is that emulating means serving Vaishnavas. When we're trying to serve Vaishnavas, let's say taking care of his things, taking care of his necessities and trying to serve him. So we're trying to emulate the pure Vaishnavas in that sense. Sometimes it creates obstacles because that Vaishnava doesn't like too much involvement of that person in his life. So how to create balance in that way?
I'm not really understanding the question.
Let's say emulating the characteristic of Vaishnava means serving other Vaishnavas, the superior Vaishnavas. Let's say in ashram, we try to serve devotees. Okay? That's an emulation of the characteristic of pure Vaishnavas. If you try to emulate that thing and we try to serve Vaishnavas, when the other Vaishnava doesn't like too much involvement of that person in his life, too much caring in the one sense.
Vishnu Jan Swami would wash the other devotees' clothes at night. So they didn't even know who was doing it. This in Radha Damodar Vilas, he was a sannyasi and a senior disciple of Prabhupada, and these were brand new devotees. He was so humble. He was world famous for his kirtans. By 1974, he was famous throughout ISKCON as the greatest kirtaniya. And Prabhupada personally trained him, and Prabhupada glorified him. Prabhupada wrote letters glorifying his chanting. So everyone knew he was such a famous personality. He gave great classes. He was full of inspiration. When he was setting up preaching centers in Texas, Prabhupada ordered him to start 10 centers in Austin and Houston and other places. At night, the brand new devotees, they would go to sleep, like at 9 p.m. He slept much less than everybody else. So he would just take their dirty clothes, they had it in a, like they'd keep a bag with their laundry, and he would just wash it. In the morning, he would wash it and dry it and fold it up. In the morning, they'd come and they'd see the clothes were put in their locker nicely. They were all clean, and everyone was wondering who was doing it. So you can, if you want to cleverly serve Vaishnavas without them knowing, that's the best style, because Vaishnavas don't like to be served. It's a competition. We want to serve other devotees, but no one wants to be served. So there are clever ways to do it. After a while, one devotee said, okay, I want to see who's doing it. So they began staying up at night. They stayed up till 10, 11. And then they fell asleep. They couldn't. But one time, one devotee managed to stay up till 1, and he noticed that Vishnu Swami was still up at 1 in the morning. And he saw Vishnu Swami going in and washing the clothes. Which is very amazing, actually. That's another, see, as you advance, we're not interested in name, fame, and position. We're interested in actually pleasing Krishna and his devotees.
It's actually an online question from Jai Jagannath Prabhu. I guess he's watching the class in Pennsylvania. The question is, when accepted as an advanced devotee by the community of devotees, and then you fall down to Maya, it may be hard to reach out for mercy due to the fear of being judged. So what to do in that situation, I guess.
If one is sincere about advancement, one should take the humble position. If one had ascended to a lofty position and then fell down, one should humbly come back and associate with the devotees. And again, rendering service. In fact, you can use it, you can say, just see, I was not advanced. Everyone is thinking I was advanced, but actually now the proof has come out that I'm not very advanced. So now I just want to be like everybody else. So you can come back and serve within the society of devotees. And if you can't do that due to your false ego, that is your loss. You may then, that whole lifetime, if you can't come back to devotees, you may have to then take another body again to do sadhana bhakti again. If the penalty for not being humble is you have to take another material body. It's a severe penalty. So it's up to each individual devotee who's in that situation that they should take. It's up to all of us, to whatever situation we're in, to try to advance. And advancement always means taking the humble role. In fact, Srivas Thakur, he wasn't fallen. He's of course one of the Panchatattva, and he's Narada Muni, he's Nitya Siddha, he cannot be fallen. But when Gopal Chapala, one an envious Brahmin, put the paraphernalia for the worship of Durga on his doorstep one night, when he opened the door in the morning and saw meat and wine and untouchable substances on the doorstep, because this envious person tried to make him look like a Shakta, then Srivas Thakur, he called all the people of Navadvip. He said, come and see now. Now the truth has been revealed. I tried to hide it. But here's the truth. I'm actually very fallen. I'm a meat eater. I drink wine. I'm a Shakta. The Vaishnavas are considered very elevated. And worshippers of Durga, they're called Shaktas. And they're generally very low class. They're thieves and murderers and rascals. So what to speak of not trying to be glorified? He went out of his way. He went out of his way. He called all the people and said, now I'm totally fallen. And what happened, it's described, this is in Adi Lila chapter 17, the people simply didn't believe it. They said, we know that you're actually very, who is this sinful person who has done this? So this, the sinful person did it was named Gopal Chapala, and he had to suffer horribly. Shivas didn't take any offense himself, but the characteristic of the Lord is he cannot tolerate that. So within 3 days, this Gopal Chapala, he got leprosy. He had to go to the bank of the Ganga. You can't live, it's an infectious disease. And he suffered horribly for many years. Then when Lord Chaitanya came back to Navadvip after he had taken sannyas, he came back, then this Gopal Chapala begged him, what can I do? And Lord Chaitanya was very angry. The only recourse is if you go and beg Shivas for forgiveness. And even Shivas was so kind, he immediately forgave him, and then Lord Chaitanya gave him love of God. So as soon as the offense is removed by asking forgiveness from the devotee you offended, then you actually are eligible to get love of God. Even this Gopal Chapala. So pure devotees, if someone that makes them look bad, they use that as, this is a great opportunity to show everyone that I'm very fallen. Take it as a great opportunity. Hearing these things, we should try to emulate, follow in the footsteps. Emulate means to follow in the footsteps. We should try to become like this. Is the basic point of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, hearing the glories of the Lord and hearing the glories of pure devotees, is to try to develop the qualities of pure devotees. There's so many pastimes, the qualities of these great devotees. Maharaj Prickett had the power to nullify the curse. He had tremendous power. He was a pure devotee. He could have nullified the curse of Sringi, the Brahmin boy, but he elected not to. He decided to accept the curse. See how detached devotees are, so detached. Or Vritrasura. Vritrasura is an amazing personality, but Asura means demon. He was a demon. Actually, he was a pure devotee. How he became a demon is an amazing story, which we will not have time to go into, but he was on the battlefield. He knew he would be killed by Indra, and he was and Indra was lamenting and in anxiety, and Vritrasura said, do your duty. Kill me. I know you have the thunderbolt given by Lord Vishnu. So Vritrasura, he was so detached that he was ready to be killed. Even after Indra cut off one of his arms, he was still fighting. Then Indra cut off the second arm, and he was still rushing forward to devour him. He was very large. He was a huge asura. He was in ecstasy all the time because he knew this is Krishna's plan. So we can always be happy. Like if we go on book distribution and people don't take a book, they turned down Krishna himself. They left the spiritual world. What to speak of turning down us? We shouldn't expect that everyone we approach is going to buy a book. It's not rational. And it's a great opportunity to become humble. If you perform your duty for Krishna's pleasure, you'll always be in ecstasy regardless of the result. That's a major theme of Bhagavad Gita. We cannot be attached to result because the result is not within our power. We cannot bring about a certain result. What we can bring about is we can develop the state of intense happiness within our hearts by being totally devoted to Krishna. And that will satisfy us. That is within our power. The internal psychological condition is within your control. But the externals are manipulating the material. You have absolutely no control to do it. Krishna may give you power temporarily to do things, but if you abuse that power, then it's taken away. If you get carried away by delusions of grandeur.
Thank you, Guru. You mentioned Maya is such that if you get out of line for one moment, it's this continual dragging down enthusiasm. So how does one maintain that vigilance? Like Prabhupada said, you're not afraid of Maya. So how does that realization develop that one is able to be protected or vigilant enough so that they're not at any moment?
The sure sign is when you start to become unhappy and morose and attached and full of anxiety, then you know you're slipping into illusion. Generally, when you're getting into illusion, you can't really tell that you're in illusion. That's one of the powers of Maya, is you still think everything's okay. But because we want to be happy, this is how you can check. As soon as you start feeling anxiety and you're unhappy and you have no more inspiration, then you know, then the alarm should go off in your mind that you're actually falling into Maya. You're being attracted by Maya. See, Jada Bharat, Bharat Maharaj, he was falling into Maya but didn't recognize it. Maya's, the way Maya conquers you is she makes you think that everything's okay. Even though she controls you and in such a way that you don't recognize that you're being controlled. This is her amazing potency, actually. So if you stay in association devotees, that's another point, is we're blessed by the association, then the other devotees can help you. They can see when you're falling into illusion, when your face is morose, when you're always unhappy and have no inspiration, then the devotees understand, okay, he's falling into Maya, so they can help you. Or you should also be alert. You should be vigilant. You should always be alert to what the mind is doing. You should always be alert to where you're at in devotional service. You have to be very introspective. Prabhupada says like a sage, an introspective sage, an alert. Because we're going, the goal is to experience ecstatic love of God. And so if we're not experiencing spiritual happiness and satisfaction and inspiration for serving the mission of the spiritual master, then we should understand we're slipping into Maya. Maya, in one of her many forms, has actually conquered us imperceptibly. So if you're alert and you're humbly associating with other devotees, you actually cannot fall into illusion. If you're alert to the goal is to get purified. If you're always thinking, how can I get purified? At every second you're thinking, how can I get purified? How can I get out of illusion? How can I develop the kind of ecstatic love that we're hearing about of these great Vaishnavas? If you're hankering, you know all these things.
I really appreciate that last one, not having that intense desire. And then we have so many solutions for that, but maybe you could just explain then, how does that intense desire meant? Because that would carry us out of the, like you're saying, the tendency.
Prabhupada, in his lectures, he would always repeat the point about the threefold miseries. Again and again, if you listen to Prabhupada's lectures, it's like one of the major themes. So you should always understand the material world is full of misery. And remember how much you suffered before you became a devotee. Always keep a few images in your mind of how you suffered tremendously. When your girlfriend chased you out of the house with a rolling pin to beat you up. When you took in too many drugs and you collapsed on the ground and your face was cemented into the floor in a pool of vomit. Just remember all your pastimes. Remember, because obviously we suffered. Why did we come to the Hare Krishna movement? Is because we suffered, at least psychologically. Even if we didn't indulge in the grosser forms. The more grossly you try to enjoy, the more you suffer horribly. How many times did your girlfriend scream at you and threaten you and pulled out a rolling pin or a knife and tried to attack you and you had to run down the stairs? And how many times do we take too much alcohol or other things and suffer tremendously? Or even if we're relatively pure and we didn't do all those things, just our mind was always dissatisfied. You cannot be happy without Krishna. The fundamental axiom of Bhakti Yoga is you cannot be happy. The soul is designed, its constitutional construction and inherent nature. It cannot be happy without serving Krishna. You can do anything. You can be King Indra. Indra is always in anxiety. He has everything, literally everything you could want in terms of material facilities, what everyone is trying to get on this planet. And he's always in anxiety. You see, Indra appears many times in the Bhagavatam. He's always in anxiety. He neglects Brihaspati. The sixth canto, that's how the Chitraketu became, the king became Vritrasura. It opens up with King Indra, and he's just enjoying the apsaras are dancing in front of him. He's intoxicated by his power and opulence and grandeur. He can create planets. He can destroy planets. He has godly powers. When Vishnu's out of the scene, he can get carried away that he's God. And he has fantastically beautiful heavenly damsels called Apsaras. Apsara. And they're just dancing in front of him, and they're bards glorifying him, singers, and everyone is singing his deeds, all the last things he's done in the last 300. He reigns as Indra for more than 300 million years. They're singing his glories. He's like God. You can actually forget. That's why we came to this world, to be like Indra. Certainly not to work at 7-Eleven. So he got, this is the sixth canto, he got carried away. And Brihaspati came, his guru came to the assembly of the devas, and he ignored him. He did nothing to show him respect. And Brihaspati thought, okay, I have to teach him a lesson. So he just disappeared. And Indra all of a sudden he realized, oh no. And he ran, he looked all over, he couldn't, even though Indra has mystic powers to travel to any planet, he couldn't find Brihaspati because there are levels of access. The universe is like a virtual reality system, like a computerized system with different levels of access according to your qualifications. So Brihaspati, Indra couldn't find Brihaspati. He just couldn't find him anywhere, though Indra can go everywhere, all over the universe, doing things. Brihaspati was superior. So Indra was, he thought, oh no, now I'm really going to be ruined. And simultaneously, Bali Maharaj, who is actually a devotee, he's the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, he's actually a devotee, but it's interesting that sometimes the devotees are in a position where they're not acting like devotees. But Krishna's supreme arrangement. So he was the king of the demons, Bali Maharaj, the king of the asuras. And the asuras are always looking for a chance whenever the devas screw up. They're ready to conquer their kingdom and usurp everything. So Bali Maharaj, he began worshipping his spiritual master. And he got so much power that he just conquered the heavenly planets. He showed up with an army. And actually they ran away just seeing his power. The demigods took the form of birds and just flew away. They left their city, Amaravati, their capital city. So Bali Maharaj just moved in and began enjoying the heavenly planets. So then Indra thought, well, I have to get another spiritual master. So he got a spiritual master named Vishvarup. But Vishvarup, although qualified and powerful Brahmin, was also partial to the asuras. So while he was doing the yajnas, he would occasionally offer some oblations on behalf of the asuras. And when Indra found out, he came with his sword and cut off his head. So his first guru he offended, and then the second guru he killed. Now he's really in. It just keeps getting worse at each stage. So the father of Vishvarup was named Tvasta. He was a great mystic Brahmin. He had all kinds of mystical powers. He became furious at Indra. So he did a huge yajna to kill Indra. And out of the fire came Vritrasura. Vritra means cover. He was the asura who was so big he covered the whole planet. He could cover a whole planet. And you can see in the sixth canto, when he came to fight against the demigods are like little guys about this tall, and he's huge, and he just tramples them and smashes them in battle. So at each stage, Indra had to get into worse, and Vritrasura was actually Chitraketu, a pure devotee, was cursed. That's another whole pastime we won't get into. So Vritrasura is a pure devotee in the body of a demon, fighting against Indra, and then Indra realized he had to kill Vritrasura, and so he had to kill a pure devotee, not only a spiritual master, but a pure Vaishnava he had to kill in battle. So he was in great anxiety, and finally he had to do it, and then after that he was chased by sin personified in the form of a tubercular woman. She was coughing up blood. Blood was coming down. Her whole sari was covered with blood. There's a picture in the sixth canto. So she's saying, wait for me, don't run away. She had mystic power, so she was flying through the air, and Indra was running, you know, he was also flying with the mystic powers to escape from her. She's saying, where are you going? Wait for me. I'm coming to embrace you. She was ghastly, coughing up blood, a hag, an old woman, you know, with horrible, disgusting torment. So Indra, to escape from her, Indra had to go into a lake and hide in the lake. He has mystic power, so he can stay underwater. And for many years, he had to meditate underwater. That was his penance for killing a pure devotee, killing a qualified Brahmin, and insulting Brihaspati. All of these things. things he had to do because he was attached to his enjoyment, his material enjoyment, his enjoyable position. So being, you see, this is actually extremely important. If we have any lingering desires to enjoy the material world, if you do, you can actually become Indra. Prabhupada said once, he said, most of my disciples want to go to the heavenly planets. So if you're an ISKCON devotee and you serve your guru properly your whole life, but you have many material desires, then you go to the heavenly planets. And we're thinking foolishly that that will be the solution to all of our problems. We can enjoy for 300 million years, which is practically forever. But it goes by very quick, actually, and it's full of anxiety. That's the point of these stories in the Bhagavatam. Even if you succeed, if you get the best material facilities of all, you will suffer. You will suffer anxiety. Many other stories of how Indra was in anxiety. Anytime a yogi was doing austerities, Indra would get in tremendous anxiety and send a beautiful apsara to make him fall down. And he would get into all kinds of difficulties. Sometimes the great sages, when they were tempted by the girls, they would get angry and curse. They would curse the girls to become crocodiles. or Indra himself would be cursed. So many difficulties Indra had to undergo. So having material desires means you're just asking for trouble, the basic message. You're asking for big trouble. Anyone can go who wants to go. It's way over time, so please leave. Anyone, don't have to stay.
Is there a way to channelize Maya into a positive aspect, into Krishna consciousness, so that you live in Krishna consciousness and Maya at the same time, but you still grow in your spirituality?
If you happen to be the Nam Acharya Shuddha Haridas Thakur, you can engage Maya in your service. Everybody else has to say no to Maya. Haridas Thakur, there were two incidents, not just one. A prostitute came, we know the story, that prostitute came, but Maya herself, after that, Maya herself came to test him. That's a whole other pastime in Anjali chapter 3 of Chaitanya Charitamrita. And she was so attractive, it's described when she came into his cave, her body was just so beautiful, it lit up the whole place by her effulgence. Everyone would just become mad after just by hearing her ankle bells. Everyone would become mad after her. So she came to the cave of Haridas Thakur in the dead of night and said, "My dear Thakur, I want to enjoy with you. You're so qualified. You're such a great preacher. I want to enjoy with you. And it's the nature of saintly persons to satisfy everyone's desire, and I'm suffering without you. Please don't let me suffer." Saintly persons always relieve the sufferings of others. She began her spiel. And Haridas Thakur, anyone else would have just been, if they were a devotee, they would have tried to run away. If they were a karmi, they would have just said, they were immediately, yeah, let's enjoy. So there's no question of being neutral in that situation. Either you're running away madly, or you're totally attracted, you fall down instantly. So what did Haridas Thakur do? He said, "I've taken this vow." He said, "Yes, I will satisfy you, but I have to finish my vow. The vow to chant. I've taken a vow to chant a billion names in a month. But as soon as the vow is finished, I will certainly satisfy your desire and enjoy with you," he said. So, and he said, "Sit down and listen to the chanting." So she said, before sitting down, she began to manifest postures that would have bewildered the greatest philosopher, it says there. That's exactly what's stated there. She began manifesting various postures. And Haridas Thakur was simply not attracted because he was relishing ecstatic love of God. So he could not be attracted. And after 3 days, then she said, "Your chanting is never finished. What is this? You're cheating me," she said straight out. The other one, the prostitute, actually, her heart melted and she surrendered and became a pure devotee. Maya's already a pure devotee. She's a servant of Krishna. So she said, you're actually cheating me." And Haridas Thakur said, "What can I do?" With folded hands, he was very respectful. "I've taken this vow." And then she revealed, she said, "I am the illusory energy personified. I've come to test you. Everyone else I've conquered, your mind alone have I failed to attract." That's what she said, "Your mind alone have I failed to attract." So how to, your question is how to engage Maya. Basically, for us, you don't. You cannot engage Maya. You'd be lucky if you're not in Maya. Maya's always coming to test us, but we just say, our basic program is we say no to Maya and yes to the instructions of the spiritual master. That's the basic program. Maya will come, and especially for new devotees, she must test, that's her duty. And that'll help you to advance. Maya's actually helping you to advance by making you more eager and determined and intense. Because we would be a little bit more lazy if Maya were not testing. We'd be loitering, Prabhupada says, loitering in the material world. So Maya, and a serious devotee is not in anxiety about Maya. He knows Maya will come, and he always says no. He says, please, I just want to serve Krishna, and she then lets you go. She doesn't, if you're actually serious, she tests you, and then she releases you and congratulates you. Maya is mainly a problem for devotees who are not very serious. There was another wonderful incident with Nara Narayan Rishi. Actually, we will stop at this point. It's getting too much. But that's another great story. When Indra tried to make Nara Narayan Rishi fall down, he didn't get an anxiety. He just created more beautiful girls and said, take these back with you to Indra. I can do better than that. So he was really cool. Of course, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so he could not be attracted by illusion. But outside of the case of Haridas Thakur, Narayan Vaishnava, and Prabhupada also says Narada Muni, because in the seventh canto he was with the young and attractive wife of Hiranyakasipu, alone in the ashram. Prabhupada says, outside of these three, no one should imitate. Or Ramananda Roy, actually, he did the most amazing thing of all. He was dressing naked dancing girls for the pleasure of Lord Jagannath, training them to dance. Ramananda Roy, of course, is Vishaka. So he didn't identify himself as male form. He's a gopi. He identified himself as a gopi in order to serve the Lord. He was training the girls to dance. Also, I want to make a minor correction to something I said a couple days ago in class about Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji, the godbrother of Srila Prabhupada. Because we got onto so many subjects, he was actually a very advanced devotee. He was not one of those who tried to chant and imitate Haridas Thakur. He was actually qualified. He was perhaps the only person in Gaudiya Math or ISKCON who was actually qualified to chant all day long, constantly. His godbrothers, some of them were envious of him. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, everyone out on book distribution and preach. And this Akinchana Krishnadas was so exalted, he would just sit and chant in ecstasy in front of the deities all day long. And the other disciple said, Guru Maharaj, this person, he doesn't want to render service. He's too puffed up. And so Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, okay, you sit and chant. You chant also all day long. No problem. Everyone come and sit. So they all sat. First day, they were struggling a little bit. They were fidgeting, and they can't, because if you're not qualified, you can't sit and chant all day long. So after a few days, they came to Guru Maharaj and said, well, Guru Maharaj, we can't do this. And he said, I just see, you were envious of him. You were complaining about him, but he's actually qualified. You go and preach, because that's how you will advance. So he was a very exalted Paramahansa. He was Prabhupada's godbrother. And Radhanath Maharaj tells the wonderful story how he saw the meeting between Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji and Srila Prabhupada in Vrindavan. And although Radhanath Maharaj didn't understand any Bengali, and they spoke entirely in Bengali, just their facial expressions, the way they loved each other and respected each other. One was a great Paramahansa preacher, Srila Prabhupada, and another was a great Paramahansa Babaji, which is very rare, actually. Mostly they're imitators. But he was actually qualified. He was a great soul. On every Ekadasi, he would chant all night long, the entire night, in ecstasy, no struggle. Devotees would stay up and try to chant with him, the all-night vigils. If you're qualified, it's wonderful. And he would effortlessly do this. He would just chant the whole night, japa, in ecstasy. So we shouldn't be envious of other devotees who are getting mercy. We should actually serve them humbly to get that mercy. How can we become like that? And we should know what is valuable for our advancement. If you cannot absorb your mind in hearing and chanting, as most of us cannot, that's why Prabhupada gave so many other services, deity worship and book distribution and preaching. And that's how ultimately you will get qualified to be absorbed in ecstasy, by carrying out the routine work. It always comes back to the routine work. No one should do it mechanically. It's our opportunity to get ecstatic love of God. Every little thing we're doing, worshiping Tulsi in the morning, sometimes what do you think? Oh, it's another Tulsi puja. It's so boring. But it's actually, this is our chance to get ecstatic love of God. We should eagerly embrace it and get angry at our mind. If the mind is so demonic and stupid and dull that it's not attractive, we should be really heavy on our mind. This nonsense mind doesn't want to serve Krishna. How disgusting. It wants the gutter of sense gratification. It wants to drink the dirty water in the gutter of Kali Yuga sense gratification. It doesn't want to serve Krishna. We should get really heavy on our mind. We should be very lenient and loving with the other devotees. If a devotee is sick and couldn't come to Mangalartik, you shouldn't say, "You nonsense, why didn't you come to Mangalartik?" You should help him. Oh, he has some physical problem, maybe needs some help or something. Of course, if it's a long-term thing and not coming to Arctic, then you have to preach to him a little bit the value of the necessity of it. Whereas on ourselves, we should instantly be very heavy on ourselves. Then you can advance nicely. Srila Prabhupada ki.